Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 563, titled A Tale of Two Heroes. This is being recorded on August 6th of the year 2006. This is going to be a long challenging broadcast, reading a very long article, so I'm not going to have time to install or to interject, I should say, nearly as much supplemental discussion. For that reason, the websites collectively are very important here, including and especially the Spitfire website, which features long article-length written descriptions of the programs. There is often information in the descriptions that I did not have time to fit into the broadcast itself, and that will probably be the case with this. So www.spitfirelist.com and the many linked websites, audio and print, are vital here. As I speak on August 6th of 2006, the Middle East is exploding, a la Barry Maguire and the Eve of Destruction. I will be speaking about that next week and probably in weeks to come. Suffice it to say that is so often the case with so many things, including and especially events in the Middle East, it is far more complex than we have been told. And as veteran listeners might guess, it's even worse than what we've been told, as if that would be possible. But it is, and I'll be telling you about that next week. However, in this broadcast, we're going to be examining some of the considerations vis-a-vis September 11th, and specifically the two heroes that are the focus of the broadcast are not only the late John O'Neill, the FBI operative in charge of the Al-Qaeda investigation, but also his right-hand man during that investigation, a remarkable then 29-year-old Lebanese-American named Ali Soufan, last name S-O-U-F-A-N. And with the horrible things now unfolding in Lebanon, I think it is in a way appropriate to examine not only an Arab American who is the embodiment of the very best in the American character and the very best in the Arab character, an individual who, if people had listened to him, might very well have prevented September 11th, and his understanding of Arab culture and his heroism and subtlety helped to uncover some of the facts concerning September 11th. We're going to plunge right in. I'm going to read this article start to finish. The article is from the New Yorker magazine of July 10th and 17th of 2006, or July 10th through 17th. The article is The Agent, subtitled, Did the CIA Stop an FBI Detective from Preventing 9/11? It's by Lawrence Wright, and it reads as follows. On October 12, 2000, in the deepwater port of Aden, Yemen, the USS Cole, a guided missile destroyer weighing 8,300 tons, was docked at a fueling buoy. The Cole, which cost $1 billion to build, was one of the most survivable ships in the U.S. Navy with 70 tons of armor, a hull that could withstand an explosion of 51,000 pounds per square inch, and stealth technology designed to make the ship less visible to radar. As the Cole filled its tank, a fiberglass fishing boat containing plastic explosives approached the ship. Two men brought the skiff to a halt amidships, smiled and waved, then stood at attention. The symbolism of this moment was exactly what Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, had hoped for when he approved a plan to attack an American naval vessel. Quote, "The destroyer represented the West," unquote, bin Laden said later. "The small boat represented Muhammad," unquote. The shockwave from the blast shattered windows on shore. 2 miles away, people thought there'd been an earthquake. The fireball that rose from the waterline swallowed a sailor who had leaned over the rail to see what the men in the skiff were up to. The blast opened a hole 40 feet by 40 feet in the port side of the ship, tearing apart sailors below decks who were waiting for lunch. 17 of them perished and 39 were wounded. Several sailors swam through the blast hole to escape the flames, and the great man of war looked like a gutted animal. It was Al-Qaeda's second successful strike against American targets. In August of 1998, operatives had bombed the United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania simultaneously, killing 224 people. Yet an important part of the Cole plot had failed. Fahd, Al-Qusso, a member of Al-Qaeda's support team in Aden, was supposed to videotape the blast for propaganda purposes, but he slept through a morning alarm and did not set up his camera in time. Qusso was in a taxi at the moment of the explosion, and he immediately went into hiding. Shortly after the attack, Ali Soufan, a 29-year-old Lebanese-American, was driving across the Brooklyn Bridge when he received a page from the New York office of the FBI, where he was employed as a special agent. He was told to report to work at once. At the time, Soufan was the only FBI agent in the city who spoke Arabic, and one of only eight in the United States. He had joined the New York office in the fall of 1997, and his talents were quickly spotted by John O'Neill, the head of the FBI's National Security Division, which is devoted to combating terrorism. The following February, when bin Laden issued a fatwa declaring war on America, Soufan wrote a trenchant report on Islamic fundamentalism that O'Neill distributed to his supervisors. After the 1998 embassy bombings, Soufan helped assemble the initial evidence linking them to bin Laden. Soufan's language skills, his relentlessness, and his roots in the Middle East made him an invaluable... in helping the FBI understand Al-Qaeda, an organization that few Americans were even aware of before the embassy bombings. O'Neill, who had joined the FBI 25 years earlier, referred to the young agent as a national treasure, unquote. Despite Soufan's youth and his relatively short tenure, O'Neill placed him in charge of the Cole investigation. As it turned out, Soufan became America's best chance to stop the attacks of September 11th. Soufan speaks rapidly, and there is still a hint of Lebanon in his voice. He has an open face and an engaging smile, although there are circles under his eyes from too many long nights. Soufan is a Muslim, but he doesn't follow any particular school of Islam. Instead, he is drawn to mystical thought, especially that of Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese-American poet. He told me that he has an interest in the Kabbalah because, quote, it appeared at a time when the political environment for the Jews was so harsh that they used this philosophy to escape their anguish, unquote. When he wants to relax, he watches reruns of Seinfeld. He's seen every episode three or four times, or Bugs Bunny cartoons. One of his favorite writers is Karen Armstrong, whose biographies of Muhammad and the Buddha knit together history and religion in a way that makes sense to him. Soufan grew up in Lebanon during the calamitous civil war when cities were destroyed and terrorists were empowered by lawlessness and chaos. His father was a journalist in Beirut, and as a child, Soufan helped out at the business magazine his father produced, often carrying gallows to the print shop. In 1987, when Soufan was 16, the family moved to the United States. Soufan's most vivid initial impression of his adopted country was that it was safe. Quote, "Also, it allowed me to dream," he said. Soufan lived in Pennsylvania, and he never suffered from prejudice because he was a Muslim Arab. In high school, he won many academic awards. He attended Mansfield University in central Pennsylvania, where he was elected president of the student government. In 1997, he received a master's degree in international relations from Villanova University outside Philadelphia. He initially planned to continue his studies in a PhD program, but he had developed a fascination with the U.S. Constitution, in particular with its guarantees of freedom of speech, religion, and assembly, and the right to a speedy trial. Quote, "People who were born into this system may take it for granted," he said. "You don't know how important these rights are if you haven't lived in a country where you can be arrested or killed and not even know why," unquote. Like many naturalized citizens, Soufan felt indebted for the new life he had been given. Although he was poised for an academic career, he decided, almost as a joke, unquote, he says, to send his resume to the FBI. He thought it was nearly inconceivable that the Bureau would hire someone with his background. Yet in July of 1997, a letter arrived instructing him to report to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia in 2 weeks. Upon graduation, Soufan went to the New York Bureau. He was soon assigned to the I-40 squad, which concentrated mainly on the Islamist paramilitary group Hamas, But in 1998, on the day after the East African Embassy bombings, O'Neill drafted him into I-49, which had become the lead unit in the FBI's investigation of Al-Qaeda. O'Neill was one of a few top managers in the FBI who recognized early the danger that Al-Qaeda posed to America. His intensity was unyielding and his manner was often abrasive. He could be brutal not only to those under him but to his superiors who he felt were not fully committed to an investigation. Soufan proved to be a tireless ally, willing to work nights and holidays. Quote, O'Neill adored him, and Ali felt the same way, Carlos Fernandez, an agent who knew both men well, observed. Again quoting, they were equals in many ways. If you say something to Ali, he'll remember it word for word 10 years from now. John was also great at remembering names and connecting the dots. They could go on for hours putting things together, unquote. The fact that a novice like Soufan had direct access to O'Neill aroused some resentment among the other agents, but the Bureau had nobody else with his skills and dedication. Quote, John and I often talked about the need to clone Ali, Kenneth Maxwell, an FBI official who was then Soufan's superior, told me. The afternoon of the Cole bombing, Soufan and a few dozen other agents flew to Yemen to begin looking for evidence that could be used against Al-Qaeda in court. A larger contingent, which included O'Neill, was held up in Germany for a week waiting for permission to enter the country. Yemen was a particularly difficult place to start a terrorist investigation, as it was filled with active Al-Qaeda cells and with sympathizers at very high levels of the government. On television, Yemeni politicians called for jihad against America. When the agents landed in Aden the day after the attack, Soufan looked out at a detachment of the Yemen Special Forces who wore yellow uniforms with old Russian helmets. Each soldier was aiming an AK-47 at the U.S. plane. A jittery, 12-man hostage rescue team which had been sent along to protect the FBI agents responded by brandishing their M4s and handguns. Soufan realized that everyone might die on the tarmac if he didn't do something quickly. He opened the plane's door. One Yemeni soldier was holding a walkie-talkie. Soufan walked directly toward him, carrying a bottle of water as the guns followed him. It was 110 degrees outside. You look thirsty, Soufan said in Arabic to the officer with a walkie-talkie. He handed him the bottle. Is it American water? The officer asked. Soufan assured him that it was, adding that he had American water for the other soldiers as well. The Yemenis considered the water such a precious commodity that some would not drink it. With this simple act of friendship, the soldiers lowered their weapons. Soufan divided the agents on the ground into four teams. The first three were responsible for forensics, intelligence, and security. The last was devoted to exchanging information with Yemeni authorities. Just getting permission from the Yemeni government to go to the crime scene, the wounded warship in the Aden harbor, required lengthy negotiations with hostile officials. Security was a great concern, considering that automatic weapons were ubiquitous in the country, especially in rural areas. But Barbara Bodine, the American ambassador, refused to allow the agents to carry heavy arms. She was concerned about offending the Yemeni authorities. When Soufan and the investigators visited the ship, clumps of flesh were strewn below decks amid the tangled mass of wire and metal. FBI divers, hoping to make DNA identifications of the victims and the bombers, netted body parts floating in the waters around the ship. Looking through the huge blast hole, Soufan could see the mountainous ancient city of Aden rising above the curved harbor like a classical amphitheater. He figured that, somewhere in the city, a camera had been set up to record the explosion since terrorists regularly documented their work. Although the bombers were likely dead, a cameraman might still be at large. When O'Neill finally arrived in Aden with the other agents, he was puzzled upon getting off the plane to see the Yemeni soldiers saluting. I told them you were a general, Soufan explained to him. Yemen is a status-conscious society, and because Soufan had promoted O'Neill to general, his counterpart was General Ghalib Qamish, Q-A-M-I-S-H, the head of Yemeni intelligence. Every night when the Yemeni authorities did business, Soufan and O'Neill spent hours pushing for access to witnesses, evidence, and crime scenes. Initially, the Yemenis told them that since both of the bombers were dead, there was nothing to investigate. But who gave the money, Soufan asked? Who provided the explosives? The boat? He gently prodded the Yemenis to help him. A few days after the bombing, the Yemenis brought in two known associates of bin Laden's for questioning. One was named Jamal Badawi, the other was Fahd Al-Kuso, the man who had failed to videotape the coal attack. Both men were Yemeni citizens. Kuso, who ran a guest house in Aden for jihadis, had turned himself in after family members were questioned. He did not admit his role in the coal plot, but he and Badawi confessed that they had recently traveled to Afghanistan and had met there with a one-legged jihadi named Khalad. Badawi said that he bought a boat for Khalad, who, he explained, had wanted to go into the fishing business. The Yemenis eventually determined that this was the boat used in the coal bombing. When Soufan heard that Kuso had mentioned the name Khalad, he was startled. He had heard it from a source he had recruited a few days earlier in Afghanistan. The source had told him that he had met a fighter in Kandahar with a metal leg who was one of bin Laden's top lieutenants. When Soufan asked to speak to Kuso and Badawi, the Yemenis told him that the men had sworn on a Quran that they were innocent of any crime. For them, that settled the matter. Soufan and O'Neill knew that General Khamish represented their best hope of gaining any cooperation. He was a small, gaunt man whose face reminded Soufan of Gandhi's. Despite the tensions between the two sides, Khamish had been calling his American colleagues Brother John and Brother Ali. One night, O'Neill and Soufan spent many hours asking Khamish for passport photographs of suspected plotters, especially that of Khalad. He said repeatedly that the FBI was not needed on the case, but O'Neill and Soufan pointed out that the sooner they could interrogate suspects linked to the coal bombing, the sooner they might obtain intelligence that could destroy Al-Qaeda. The following night, Khamish announced, "I have your photos for you." Soufan immediately sent Khalad's photo to the CIA. He also faxed it to an FBI agent in Islamabad, Pakistan. The agent showed it to Soufan's source in Afghanistan, who identified the man as Khalad, the Al-Qaeda lieutenant. This suggested strongly that Al-Qaeda was behind the coal attack. Another break came that same evening when a 12-year-old boy named Hani went to the local police. He said that he had been fishing on a pier when the bombers placed their skiff in the water. One of the men had paid the boy 100 Yemeni rials, about 60 cents, to watch his Nissan truck and boat trailer, but he never returned. When the police heard Hani's story, they locked him in jail and arrested his father as well. After repeated requests, the Americans got permission to interview the boy and to examine the launch site. Hani was scared, but he provided a description of the bombers. One was heavy, and the other was, quote, handsome, unquote. An Arabic-speaking naval investigator named Robert McFadden offered the boy some candy. He then said that the bombers had invited him and his family to take a ride in the boat, which was white, with red carpeting on the floor. When Soufan heard this, he deduced that the bombers had been trying to determine how much weight the skiff could carry. The abandoned truck and trailer were still at the launch site. It was a major mistake on the part of Al-Qaeda not to have retrieved them. By checking registration records, investigators connected the truck and trailer to a house in a neighborhood of Aden called Burayka, B-U-R-A-Y-Q-A-H. When Soufan went to the house, which was surrounded by a wall and a gate, he had an eerie feeling. This residence had a striking resemblance to the house in Nairobi where the bomb for the 1998 embassy attack had been made. Inside, in the master bedroom, there was a prayer rug oriented to the north toward Mecca. The bathroom sink was full of body hair. The bombers had shaved and performed ritual ablutions before going to their deaths. Soufan's men collected a razor and hair samples, which might provide the FBI with the DNA evidence necessary to establish the identity of the killers. So far, the investigators at the coal site had found only a couple of bone fragments that didn't belong to American sailors. Investigators found that another house in Aden had been rented by the terrorists. It was registered to Abda Hussein Mohammed. The name was dimly familiar to Soufan. At one point during the Nairobi investigation, a witness had mentioned an al-Qaeda operative named Nasheri, who had proposed attacking an American vessel in Aden. Soufan did some research and discovered that Nasheri's full name was Abdul Rahim Muhammad Hussein Abda al-Nasheri. The middle names were the same, just reversed. Soufan's hunch paid off when American agents discovered a car in Aden that was registered to Nasheri. It was another strong link between al-Qaeda and the Cole attack. A couple of weeks after the bombing, Yemeni authorities placed Badawi and Kuso, the two al-Qaeda operatives, under arrest, apparently as a precaution. Soufan continued to press General Qamish to let him interrogate the men directly, and finally, after several weeks, Qamish relented. Soufan spent hours preparing for the encounters with the goal of finding some common ground with his subjects. Often, the bond centered on religion. Ali was very spiritual, Carlos Fernandez recalled. In Yemen, he was reading the Quran at night. He would talk to these guys about their beliefs. Sometimes, he would actually convince them that their understanding of Islam was all wrong. In the interrogation of Badawi, Soufan learned that the skiff had been purchased in Saudi Arabia. Soufan questioned Kuso over the course of several days. Kuso was small, wiry, and insolent, with a wispy beard that he kept tugging on. Before Soufan could even begin, a local intelligence official came into the room and kissed Kuso on both cheeks, a shocking signal that the security services were sympathetic to the jihadis. McFadden, who participated in the interrogations, recalled that Soufan was not intimidated. He said, quote, Ali was a natural interviewer, and he was able to dislodge Kuso from his circle of comfort, unquote. Eventually, Kuso began to open up. He had been in Afghanistan and boasted that he had fought beside bin Laden. He said that bin Laden had inspired him with his speeches about expelling the infidels from the Arabian Peninsula, in particular American troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. Soufan asked if Kuso ever planned to get married. A shy, embarrassed smile appeared. Well, then help yourself out, Soufan urged him. Tell me something, unquote. Finally, Kuso admitted that he was supposed to film the bombing, but he had overslept. The Yemenis later found a video camera at his sister's house. He also said that several months before the Kuwait attack, he and one of the bombers had delivered $36,000 to Khalad, the one-legged al-Qaeda lieutenant in Bangkok. The money, Kuso added, was meant only to buy Khalad a new prosthesis. Soufan was suspicious of this explanation. Why had al-Qaeda sent money out of Yemen just before the coal bombing took place? Money always flowed toward an operation, not away from it. He wondered if al-Qaeda had a bigger plot underway. The CIA had officials in Yemen to collect intelligence about al-Qaeda, and Soufan asked them if they knew anything about a new operation, perhaps in Southeast Asia. They professed to be as puzzled as he was. In November 2000, a month after the coal bombing, Soufan sent the agency the first of several official queries. On Soufan's behalf, the director of the FBI sent a letter to the director of the CIA formally asking for information about Khalad and whether there might have been an al-Qaeda meeting somewhere in Southeast Asia before the bombing. The agency said that it had nothing. Soufan trusted their response. He thought that he had a good working relationship with the CIA. Kuso had told Soufan that when he and the coal bomber went to Bangkok to meet Khalad, they had stayed in the Washington Hotel. FBI agents went through phone records to verify his story. They found calls between the hotel and Kuso's house in Yemen. They also noticed that there were calls to both places from a payphone in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. In April 2001, Soufan sent another official teletype to the CIA along with a passport photo of Khalad. He asked whether the telephone numbers had any significance and whether there was any connection between the numbers and Khalad. The CIA said that it could not help him. In fact, the CIA knew a lot about Khalad and his ties to al-Qaeda. The FBI and the CIA have long quarreled over bureaucratic turf, and their mandates place them at odds. The ultimate goal of the Bureau in gathering intelligence is to gain convictions for crimes. For the agency, intelligence itself is the object. If the agency had responded candidly to Soufan's requests, it would have revealed its knowledge of an al-Qaeda cell that was already forming inside the United States. But the agency kept this intelligence to itself. I come from a generation of FBI agents who have always worked closely with the CIA, Soufan told me. At the time he joined the Bureau, law enforcement had become internationalized. In the 1990s, his mentor O'Neill had established close relations with foreign police services, an approach that sometimes encroached on the CIA's territory. In 1999, O'Neill sent Soufan and his superior, Pascale DeMauro, to Jordan, where authorities had discovered that jihadis linked to al-Qaeda were plotting to bomb tourist sites and hotels. Information that the Jordanians shared with Soufan made him realize that the intelligence that the CIA was reporting was deeply flawed. His analysis forced local CIA representatives to withdraw 12 cables that they had sent to agency headquarters. On the floor of the CIA station in Amman, Soufan discovered a box of evidence that had been given to the agency by Jordanian intelligence. Such evidence is what the FBI needs in order to mount prosecutions, and no one had examined the box's contents or turned it over to the Bureau. In the box, Soufan found a map of the proposed bomb sites, which proved crucial in the prosecutions of 28 plotters in Jordan, 22 of whom were convicted. Soufan's success embarrassed the CIA, deepening the rift between the two institutions. Quote, "The CIA people couldn't stand the fact that Ali's opinion and analysis were correct," an FBI counterterrorism official who worked with Soufan told me. He was an Arabic speaker and an FBI agent on the ground who was running circles around them, unquote. Nevertheless, the CIA recognized Soufan's abilities and repeatedly tried to recruit him. "Come over to the dark side," an agency operative once said to him. "You know you're interested." Soufan said that he just laughed. We're going to continue with this article on the other side of this broadcast. By the way, if you've tuned in late, we are reading from an article from the New Yorker magazine's issue of July 10th through 17th of 2006. The article is entitled "The Agent," subtitled "Did the CIA Stop an FBI Detective from Preventing 9/11? It's by Lawrence Wright. There will be an article-length written description of this article on the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. Please do use the Spitfire website and the many, many linked websites, including the WFMU websites featuring the For the Record series on audio. It is essential, and as I've mentioned many times, there is often information in the descriptions that I did not have time to put in the original broadcast, so please do use those descriptions. They are absolutely essential. And next week, I'm going to be talking about the horrifying events now unfolding in the Middle East. For those of you who have inquired about that, as is so often the case, not only with most things, but often the Middle East in particular, the situation is far more complex than we have been told. And it's also, as veteran listeners to my broadcast might guess, a lot worse than we have been told, as impossible as that might seem at first glance. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record, program number 563, A Tale of Two Heroes, being recorded on August 6th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.